Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm chatting with Hayden Barnes, who's the open source partner manager for Hero Devs. How's it going, sir?
Great. Thanks so much for having me on, Scott.
This is such a cool company idea. Like, you and I have known each other for a long time, and we've worked on cool stuff together. But like, when I heard about this, a company that gives support for open source projects that are end of life, what a genius idea. Like, how did you get hooked up with these guys?
So I hooked up with Hero Devs based on my experience in cross-platform open source development, .NET. They got started primarily in the front-end space, projects like Angular, JS, and Node, and Vue. And as their catalog has expanded, they've been growing essentially down the stack. So they recently entered the Java space with the Spring web framework. And one of their top requested products after that was .NET. So we are working our way down the stack and building out those frameworks. Includes things like web frameworks, ASP.NET, but we're getting into systems and GUI applications and a lot more neat things like databases.
Yeah, the number of products is like shockingly large. Like I'm looking here and it's like Node all the way back to 12, Bootstrap 2, all versions of Struts. It almost seems like when I say impossibly large, I'm not just like blowing smoke. I'm saying like, how is that possible? Like how big is this group? How can you have expertise that goes that far back?
So we're a startup, about 120 employees. But unlike a lot of startups, we're not just running on VC funds. We were mostly bootstrapped from day one, thanks in large part to Google essentially blessing us as the maintainers of AngularJS when it was deprecated. And the team has significant front-end experience, which is allowing them to support the wide range of mostly JavaScript-based frameworks. Also a lot of background and experience in open source security and secure supply chain and working with these upstream projects. As we continue this journey down the stack, we bring in the expertise needed. So a fair number of hires in the Java space, particularly from the Spring community. And as we ramp up our .NET offering, I joined and we have brought on experts in .NET to round out those skills.
Interesting. Now, one of the things that I think is curious when I look at how Hero Devs is positioning this, they're saying secure drop-in replacements. So are these forks? Are you pushing them back upstream? Like how are you good open source members, but also why is it called a drop-in replacement? What am I getting if I, for example, decided I needed a copy of Angular 1.5?
Right. So in many cases, you simply you become a customer and you obtain a token through our customer portal, our package repository, and update your package sources to point to our package repository, and you get ongoing updates with high to critical severity CVEs patched. And the way we contribute as open source community members is we simply don't, take, an EOL version and fork it. We practically do. Right. An end of life version and fork it. We routinely partner with the upstream open source projects, whether that's a single maintainer, a company, a project, or, even a foundation that sponsors a number of open source projects. We have a number of arrangements we've put in place, everything from hiring key members of the project staff to sponsoring organizations like OpenJS to funding community efforts around the projects that we've taken on. So We're not simply just relying on these and taking them and, you know, packaging them and making them available, you know, at cost to enterprise customers. We are sharing revenue back and time and effort back upstream.
That's super cool. You know, and the fact that like it's using the package idea, like if you're doing struts, then you update your Maven files, your Gradle files. If you're using JavaScript, you update your package JSON. You know, you're providing a feed for an end of life thing, and you just kind of point back to that feed and the feed you get access to with that token. And then rather than having to pay money to migrate and do all of the work and test, you just stay comfortably in the past, and it's your decision whether or not you get rushed or pressured into upgrading or not. You call them NES, right? Not Nintendo, but never ending support, as opposed to long-term support or short-term support, STS.
Right. And you know, we don't want to prevent customers from upgrading. Obviously they need a long-term migration story, but oftentimes, particularly with large enterprise customers, government agencies, they need a long-term horizon to make those migrations happen. And we're simply providing that additional padding to make those migrations over time.
It's such a cool idea to do that. I just love it. Do you think that this is a solution for some of the problems that we have in the open source community? Because I think people like make stuff and the expectation is never ending support. Like, but then the never ending support might be some single maintainer project. Like these are all big projects, but I'm just pointing out that like it is unreasonable to expect never ending support. But by making that possible, they can go and innovate, do the next version, and it provides a reasonable opportunity and an option for someone who before would have been, I guess, just left on an insecure, unsupported version with no recourse at all, which is not a position you want to be in.
Right. A lot of the projects that we take on and partner with actually love that we've come along to provide this service. They can then point to us in their deprecation notices and in their release notes and say, hey, you know, we're deprecating this version on this date. If you still need support, contact Hero Devs. And that basically gets that burden off their plate. So they can continue to work upstream, innovate on new features, new functionality, and they're relieved of that support burden. So it definitely contributes to the sustainability, particularly of those volunteer, like project-based open source frameworks and toolkits. And
hey friends, it's an advertising break. We're going to take a moment and chat with our new sponsor, ShareGate by Workleap. You know, if you're thinking about deploying Copilot in an organization, but you've got a whole bunch of documents and a whole bunch of information, that can be a new challenge. Shailen Gimby, what makes it so challenging for IT teams?
Copilot is an incredible tool, but only if your Microsoft 365 environment is clean, secure, and structured. You know, if your permissions are a mess or your teams are inactive and your SharePoint sites are unstructured, you're basically setting Copilot up to pull the wrong data for the wrong people. And Copilot only works effectively if everything is in one tenant. So if your data is scattered across multiple tenants, Copilot's ability to retrieve and process information is going to be seriously limited. That's why data consolidation should be a top priority in your Copilot readiness plan. You know, you hear the saying, garbage in, garbage out. An outdated file from 8 years ago with more views might take priority over a newer, more accurate file with fewer views, leading to unreliable answers. Without cleaning up your content and structuring your data properly, you could end up with Copilot generating responses based on outdated or irrelevant files, which is exactly why we built our Copilot readiness assessment. It analyzes your tenant and gives IT teams clear insights and recommendations so they can get their environment in shape before rolling out Copilot. That way, you're not just flipping a switch and hoping for the best.
Now we're cooking with gas. This is great. Now I know how ShareGate by Workleap is going to help me out. It is packed with best practices, going to guide you at every step. It's your out-of-the-box Microsoft 365 migration tool. Check it out at ShareGate.com. And thank you for being a sponsor of Hansel Minutes. Your background, I've always found to be really fascinating because, you know, we hung out and worked on like WSL, the Windows Subsystem for Linux, and you're like a Linux head from way back. You worked at Canonical on Ubuntu. You worked at SUSE. You know, so you're like a deep tech nerd. But is it true that you were a practicing attorney?
I was.
How did you do that? Like, is that how do you be a techie and an attorney?
So, you know, the funny story behind that is, for some reason, I just never like did well in traditional computer science courses and kind of ruled it out as an option. You know, I've been tinkering with Linux since I was a teenager. My first Linux was like Red Hat 5.2. And back when you bought it in a box and it came with a book, you know, and my first experience with Linux was then having to rebuild my kernel to support my graphics card at the time, an ATA graphics card.
The classic Linux trial by fire is I can't get my graphics. I know that this is like a meme or whatever, but like, I can't get my graphics card to work. I shall compile my own kernel. The only solution to get your sound card and your graphics card working on Linux. Of course, it works today, but still. This was a thing that we did when we were teenagers.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I wrote a lot of, you know, programs to help me along the way, whether that be to pass calculus in high school, to check the status of my cases, practicing law. At the time, the county computer system was a IBM mainframe and required you to log in with an old Java 2 based applet. And I said, you know, I could just write a web front end for this to check the status of my cases. And it slowly became a, you know, entire case management system, which I then began licensing out to other local attorneys. And I was like, hey, I'm not half bad at this. And at the time I had made the transition from macOS to Windows with WSL because it gave me those desktop applications I needed for my law practice, but also access to a familiar Nix, in this case Linux, terminal where I could do my work, particularly after the butterfly keyboard debacle on the MacBook Pro, which was untenable for me. So I switched to a ThinkPad through Windows on there, started working with WSL, and then kind of just got connected through the, you know, very early WSL community and started sharing hacks with other folks, you know, playing with WSL. And eventually we decided to assemble all of those, you know, early hacks that were needed to really get the most out of WSL 1 at the time and distribute our own bespoke Linux distro for WSL called Penguin. And we packaged all of that stuff in. And it kind of goes back to that theme you brought up before, which was open source sustainability. And you know, it's like, we put some effort into this. We're going to provide community support. This is going to belong to the community. We're going to put it on the Microsoft Store and ask $10 for it, you know, and that essentially gives you a stake in that community and best effort support and some product direction input. And, you know, I thought maybe a couple hundred people would buy it. And within a few months, several thousand people had bought it. And
yeah, it was a legit thing. It was real. I paid.
Appreciate it. And we were 100%. All able to basically make it a part-time job. And then eventually it grew enough. It really helped that we were featured in the Windows Terminal sizzle reel. And I was invited to build. And I was able to slowly stop taking new clients and go work on this full time. So that was a really, really awesome journey.
That's so cool. Now, this will sound like a cheesy callback, but it's a legitimate one. In the list of reasons why one might want to avoid staying on an unsupported version of something is regulatory action, fines, and legal action. Is that just scare tactics, or is that an actual thing? Can you get in trouble if you run a product or run a website or have a thing and you are running on unsupported stuff? Like, who's going to regulate you or fine you or legally whatever you? Is it like you might get hacked and then you get sued? Or as a person with one foot in each world, why is that important to me to stay up to supported versions of stuff, secure versions of stuff?
Yeah, putting my legal hat on, there are a number of government regulations promulgated by CISA that require government contractors to patch security vulnerabilities within a certain amount of time. If you're in the insurance industry, the financial services industry, healthcare, there are additional requirements for remediating security vulnerabilities. Also, if you're a company handling customer data, particularly those forms of, financial or health data, if you are, hacked in some way, and it's determined that it was because you failed to patch a piece of software, that certainly does not look good in court. That certainly contributes to a class action, claim showing negligence. So you negligently failed to maintain your software, left a high severity CVE open that was remotely exploitable. That's how you end up paying big bucks.
Probably not a concern for my blog, but if I was holding credit card information and I negligently left something unpatched and someone stole something, PII, personally identifiable information, I could get in trouble. Now, when you said CISA, you're talking about the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. That's CISA.gov for folks who may not be familiar with that acronym.
Yep, absolutely. And any sort of company that does business with the government, and that's quite a lot, those regulations mm-hmm. attach. There are other, regulations out of the EU. If you do a lot of business in the EU or, have a subsidiary there, and those regulatory burdens are real and strict.
Now, I think that this idea that you're running, that Hero Devs is running their own package repository is such a clever one. It's such a good balance between open source, which I am a big proponent of, and capitalism, which a system in which we exist. It seems like a pretty good balance to catch that long tail of non-supported software. I wonder if it is going to be forever, though. Like, is it challenging? Do you run your own build servers to maintain and test these things? How do we have confidence that some super old 10-year-old version of something is not only been patched and fixed, but builds and runs and will keep my website running?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we do run our own build systems, and that could be a fun challenge around .NET because we run those for both Linux and Windows. And in terms of the never-ending support guarantee, the irony is that the longer these versions of open source frameworks are end of life, the demand simply goes up.
And really?
Yes.
That is counterintuitive.
It's counterintuitive, but as more and more companies and government agencies institute mandatory internal, CVE scanning tools, whether in CI/CD or just across their endpoints, they're discovering these in production. Customers I talk to who are running .NET, large customers tend to be running 10 to hundreds of .NET applications, many of which, are running on, single system over here or a small team over there. And they just find more of these over time as these policies get implemented, company-wide. So the growth on some of these very end of life, say very end of life, long since end of life versions of open source toolkits is exponential, to be honest.
Interesting. So like .NET, which is my favorite thing, the even numbers, to put it simply, are long-term support. So 6, 8, and 10 all have long-term support. So 6, .NET 6, ended support November of 2024. And when you try to download it, there's a big red like banner. This release has reached the end of life. It is no longer supported. Go to a support release. And then you can dig into their support policy, and it's a big, scary thing. But then when you get down to the end of life, you're like, well, wait a second. I've got a bunch of stuff on .NET 6. I got two choices here. I could try to upgrade to .NET 8. I could use one of the migration tools or use, you know, AI or a migration tool. Or the new thing that HeroDevs is doing, because it's mostly been JavaScript historically, is .NET 6, never-ending support. That's really cool. So that would imply then that the next version that you would support, if this goes well for HeroDevs, would be .NET 8, which goes out of support next November. So like just, you know, maybe not eight, maybe a little bit less than 2 years away. Is that the intent, to basically take those long-term supports and make them never-ending and then not do anything with the standard term supports? Or are you still trying to figure that out?
The goal right now is to focus on the LTS version, the ones that have gone end of life. We are scoping the possibility of offering our own builds of in-support LTS versions, so that when customers approach that end of life date, they can simply apply that token from the customer portal and continue receiving support post EOL. You know, but if demand is sufficient for an STS version, we'd certainly be open to that. All of our product catalog offerings are customer request driven.
So that was my next question, because these are all like, you're not saying I need to support JavaScript. You're saying I need to support Angular or Spring or whatever. But then my next question was, what about all the libraries? What about all the libraries beyond that? Because like .NET's the base class library and Node, but like what about this library or that library, which might be small or insignificant even from the perspective of HeroDevs? How would you handle something like that?
So when a customer comes to us and we perform an onboarding, you know, we obviously have the tentpole framework, but we ask them for what libraries they're dependent upon. And we sort through those and determine which ones we can continue support, which ones we would be unable to support. However, particularly in the JavaScript in the front end ecosystem, we already support a wide range of those smaller libraries, you know, that are used in a number of projects across the front end ecosystem. So with .NET, you know, we have a standard set of NuGet packages that we support, and you know, we did some research looking at the support lifecycle of the top 200. NuGet packages maintained by the community. And should we have a customer come forward that needs another NuGet package, another .NET library that's not currently on our supported list, you know, we would go through that evaluation process. Can we support this? How would we support this? Do we fork it and maintain it internally? Is this large enough, popular enough where we can actually approach the maintainer on contract and have them maintain a branch for our customers? We have a wide toolkit and a number of approaches for addressing that challenge.
There is a section on the HeroDevs website that I think like should have a bigger link, because like if you go to herodevs.com, you click on developers and you click on vulnerability directory, it's this really, really good list of all the CVEs, right? A common vulnerability and exploit is what CVE stands for. And you can go in there and say, all right, well, I want to see critical, Angular, or jQuery, high. And then it will give you this list of like all the vulnerabilities. And then the part that gets really scary is the versions affected. And then you can find out if that's a version that affects you, and then whether or not you're going to be nailed because of something being out of, you know, out of scope. Because it's like, oh, look, here's one from 2024 on .NET with the ASP.NET Core runtime. And then here's the versions affected. And it's like, oh, shoot, anything over version 6. Oh, shoot, version 6 is out of date. That's what we're trying to solve. And some of these are critical. I see Apache and Lucene and Spring. I thought this was just a really cool resource. And what I thought was nice is that there's actually an RSS feed that's like, you don't have to go to this website. Just get the feed, and you're tracking the vulnerabilities right there. So like, kudos whoever made that page, because I thought that was super helpful.
Absolutely. We certainly encourage users, you know, broadly, as well as our customers, to be proactive about these CVEs. We certainly notify our existing customers of CVEs and when fixes are incoming. There's also that more kind of responsive posture that a lot of customers have with those internal scanners and endpoint management tools. I think it's you need to have a good balance where you want to be scanning and monitoring, you know, for things you might have missed, but taking an active interest in critical CVEs that may affect your production systems, you know, your bread and butter, is certainly powerful.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've added Dependabot to my workflow, and Dependabot has been really helpful because I don't have a habit as a small business, you know, Hanselman.com, and this podcast is just me. I'm not like looking for CVEs. I need the CVE to come to me. I need the security report to come to me. And then someone needs to give me a heads up. So Dependabot for me is like, oh, this is a thing. Are you aware? And the security warnings in GitHub would then lead me to a solution like a never-ending support contract.
Yeah. And, you know, with our package repositories, you know, even if you don't monitor the vulnerability database and, you know, don't read our emails, you know that because of our SLA.
Explicitly avoid our emails. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, keep marking them as junk, so they just end up in your junk folder every time. Because of our SLA, you're going to get the fix.
You know. Oh, okay. So because it's in the feed and I'm running my regular builds, I'm going to get those fixes pulled in from package.json or Maven or Gradle or whatever.
Exactly. Exactly.
That is cool. So have you been enjoying this? This sounds like fun. Like I like a product that just sells itself. Like I know this is more you and I geeking out on a podcast, but when I heard about this being a concept, I was like, oh, what a good idea. And when you heard about it, you must have felt the same way, especially as a Linux person, because Linux is all about packages.
Yeah. Yeah. It has been a very fun challenge because, you know, especially aiming for that drop-in, you know, replacement, you know, we're packaging for Windows, a couple flavors of Linux. You know, we go and we look at the Linux packages and they're packaged slightly different for slightly different Linux distributions. And we've got to match our builds, you know, bit for bit so that everything lands in place. When you add our apt repo or our RPM repo and eventually our Winget repo to your systems.
Oh, a Winget repo as well. That's great. I love Winget. I know that you're a Linux person and I'm a Windows person, but just like we had been talking about this for, gosh, 15 years, like when apt-get for Windows was going to happen. And Winget has been such a joy. So it's great that you'll have a Winget source as a part of HeroDevs one day.
Yeah, absolutely. Because right now the, you know, Windows deployment is fairly manual, you know, it still requires downloading the binary and deploying it using endpoint management tooling, whether that's like legacy Intune or the variety of third-party products that are available on the market. but Modern Intune has Winget integration. So that'll make it much easier to deploy the latest versions of either the SDK to your developers or the runtime to your endpoints through the Winget repository.
Well, I am still, even though I love you, I'm still going to keep promoting that people upgrade because migration tools are great. You've seen me do live migrations. We've got AI-based migrations. But, you know, sometimes it's just a hassle to upgrade something to the latest and you don't have the person, you don't have the team. You know, if you've got an existing system and it works just fine and you just need it to keep working just fine and you don't want to go and upset it by upgrading or migrating to the latest, a never-ending support solution is a really clever idea. And I love that it's a drop-in replacement. So we got this, I'm looking here on products. We've got Angular and we've got Spring, we've got .NET 6 and we got Bootstrap. What a cool idea. I've just upgraded one of my sites to .NET 8, but I still have some .NET 6 sites that are out there and I'm dreading that. I guess they've been out of date for at least a half a year now. I hopefully won't get in trouble at some point. I'm looking at the NES site here and there's actually a countdown. Hero Devs is threatening me that I've been out of support for 100 and something days. I need to get to going on that. So we can check that out at herodevs.com. And where can folks find you online?
I am online on GitHub at Sir Redbeard. I am still on Twitter trying to make that work at Unix Terminal. You can join the WSL community Telegram. It's wsl.community for that link where we talk about WSL, you know, provide support if that's something you're interested in exploring. Also feel free to add me on LinkedIn.
Very cool.
Out there. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Hayden Barnes. I learned something today. I did not know that there was never-ending support for so many open source projects. I think it's a pretty interesting solution. You can check them out at herodevs.com. Learn all about never-ending support. And then Hayden is spelled H-A-Y-D-E-N Barnes. You can follow him on LinkedIn and all over social. Thanks so much for spending time with me today.
Thanks for your time, Scott. I really appreciate it.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.